You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's local watering hole. So excited to be here today. We have a very special guest with us as we're going to be diving back into the Star Wars books as we had a brand new book just released a few weeks ago. We have a squadron book. That is right. We are back with ships, and I'm so excited. The Alphabet Squadron has finally been released, and all fans can rejoice because we have an X-Wing style series back. And with me to talk about that is somebody who's never been here in the 602 Club before, but got a chance to meet last year at Dragon Con. And I'm pretty sure that you probably know him because he runs Star Wars Explained there on YouTube. So, Alex Damon, it's great to have you here, man.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me, Matt.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you could make it, especially since when I messaged you, you were like, oh no, I really like this book. I want to talk about it.
I'm ready. I've been waiting to talk about it with somebody.
Well, that'll be perfect then, because I've been waiting to talk about it as well. And mainly too, because I don't know, I'm sure for you too, they've been sending out the advanced reader copies like super early. And so you get the opportunity to read those, and then so you read it so long ago before you can really talk to anybody about it, and you're just kind of like chomping at the bit waiting for people to read it so that you can start talking about it online.
Yeah, the advanced reader copies is all of a sudden something they've been doing this year. I haven't been getting them that early until
me either.
Like Queen Shadow and Alphabet Squadron, and usually I'd get them like maybe a week early, and that was enough time. But yeah, now it's super helpful to have your content ready to go.
Well, yeah, it really is. It's much easier for us to get the reviews out the day of. And like you said, you know, when you have like maybe a week to read, depends on how busy the week is, whether you have to really cram. So yeah, it's been awesome. Before we dive into the book here, everyone, don't forget, you can find us all over the place wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on Apple Podcasts or iTunes there, hit us up, get us a star rating review. Just let people know what you think of the show. It really does help people find the show. And then of course you can also find us on Twitter at Trek FM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. We've got a listeners only discussion group that's on Facebook. It's called the Babel Conference. If you type Babel into the search field on Facebook, or you go to the website at trek.fm, any of the show pages, you'll see a button that says discussion, and that would let you right in. And then you can talk to everybody about all the shows that we have going on here in the network. And then last but not least, if you would like to send us an email, go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that will come to me and Christy. Alex, I thought one of the things that really stuck out to me this book was how psychological this book is, and that it's very much, I feel, about the cost of war and surviving war. And I really like that Alexander Freed, who also wrote Battlefront, that he tapped back into that theme, because that was very much a theme of, you know, what the first Battlefront book was all about, was just like trying to survive war. And these people, it's about the fact that they've actually survived war and a bunch of their friends haven't. And I thought that was really nice for a Star Wars book to really dig in deep to, you know, what this is like. You know, the reality of war is, you know, it seems glamorous when everybody's yub-nubbing on Endor, but the reality of that is not necessarily a pretty thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I gotta admit, I am not super fresh on Battlefront Twilight Company at all. But I think that I might go back and reread it after Alphabet Squadron, because I remember not loving Battlefront Twilight Company, but after Alphabet Squadron, I'm like, I might need to go give that another look, because I loved Alphabet Squadron. And yeah, I think even the tagline for the book is victory has a cost, or comes with a cost, or something like that. And that's the whole gist of Alphabet Squadron, is like they are literally all the sole survivors of their squadrons, and they're coming together to stand up against that one group, Shadowwing, that has been taking all their friends out.
Yeah, I thought that it was really nice as we get the I love that the torture droid has turned into like a therapy droid,
yeah,
which was great. But him, you know, kind of helping Erisa realize that what is it that every one of these people have in common is that they are a survivor, and that they're pretty much the sole survivor of their group. And so I really appreciated the fact that we gave these characters a lot of depth here right at the beginning. And I think it sets up, you know, a nice foundation then, since this is a trilogy, it'll give us a nice place to go with these characters, because they go through the ringer together in this story.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm thrilled that this is going to be a trilogy, because I thought that, well, I really enjoyed the book as a whole, but I did feel like it started a little slow in just that it's got to introduce all these characters. I was thinking it was going to be almost like, you know, X-Wing Rogue Squadron,
right?
The Legends book starts with like, everyone's here, like chapter one, Corran Horn is in a training simulation, and like we're all together immediately. That's kind of what I had as my expectation, but it was cool to see the whole team spread out and then slowly form together. And I really loved Will and Chas's part of that story. But I do look forward to the second and third books, where we don't really have to do that. We can just jump right in. Like right now I'm reading Black Spire by Delilah Dawson, and that one picks up very shortly after her previous book, Phasma, with Cardinal and Vi Moradi. And it's fun not having to be introduced to those characters, just being like, yes, they're back, let's go. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how 2 and 3 play out.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because, you know, the pace of this book is very slow at the beginning. You know, we spend, I would say, at least a good third of the book, if not almost like two-thirds of the book, really building this group into a working squadron. You know, that's really what this is about. And part of that is them overcoming a lot of the psychological obstacles that they have in that. But also it's bringing them together as the team. And I felt like it was really smart to do that, because, you know, a lot of the, like you referenced the X-Wing books, a lot of the Legends books, you know, you're dealing with characters you already know, you know, like it's Wedge and stuff like that. And yes, Wedge is like a minor character, but you already feel like you know him coming in, so you don't feel like you need to be introduced as much. This book is setting up all new characters, except for the one exception, Hera. And it gives us an opportunity to really spend time with those characters before it just dumps us into a bunch of action. So that way, by the time we're at the end of the book, I feel like Freed has done a good job of making us care, like, if everybody's actually going to survive this crazy-ass plan.
Absolutely. By the time we actually get to the action, I was on the edge of my seat, and he had set up all of this relationship stuff. Like, there's so many... I'm trying to talk without spoiling it.
Oh, you can spoil it. There's
okay, yeah, we're doing that.
No, I mean, no worries about spoilers here.
All right. So, like, the stuff with Chas and being angry at Will for taking her choice earlier in the book, and that kind of like that comes back up again at the end, where she feels like, again, he's taking her choice, but in a different way, and just watching them all react to what they've been through and how they've grown as a team and as a family. It like kind of gave me Avengers vibes a little bit, where all of these dysfunctional people have to come together and learn how to work together.
Yeah. And it was neat to be able to see the way that they do that. Cause again, so much of this story where they really start to come together is that moment where they're sent on the mission by Hera to basically, it's this hidden Jedi temple on this unnamed planet, like a moon. It's like, it's not even important enough to have a name. And I thought that was a really great way to bind these characters together, because what better way to bring people together than to stick them camping for a few days, you know, where they don't have anything to do other than to talk to each other and load up supplies. Like, it's that perfect opportunity for them to like let down their guard. And to me, again, it was smart writing. Like, you know, if you want us to really care about the characters and to feel something for them in the end, you really do want this kind of interaction. Because you need to know their stories. You need to know the psychology of these characters, or it's not going to matter, you know? And I think Frieda's pretty good at that. And, you know, Battlefront, I think, does a pretty good job of that too, of allowing you to feel, that one's more the frustration of the characters, you know, and like being in so many losing battles and everything. This one is slightly different because, you know, once they come together, you know, this team is a pretty good team, which is, that was also fun to see as well.
Yeah. And it's interesting when we look at the team that Erica Quell is still kind of on the outside, which I was surprised of by the end of the book. But yeah, that whole camping trip, she is spent off doing something else. And it's like guarding the team. It's for their benefit. But it's interesting that she hasn't reached that point yet. And I think even Nath at the end has a line about that, how she's like not quite one of them, but she's trying.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just kind of looking at her as one of the characters, and she's the main point of interest for us in the story. We're really following her story for the most part. And I liked that it was a struggle for her, somebody who had grown up in the Empire, had joined the Empire honestly because she was going to join the rebellion, but by the time she kind of got in, she just found that she couldn't leave until this, you know, Operation Cinder happens, and she can't do it anymore. Like, there's a part of her that, it almost feels like there's a part of her that breaks finally, and she just realizes, and she even says something in the book where if you can't say what you're fighting for, you know, then you shouldn't be fighting on that side. Like, if you can't give a reason for what you're doing or why people are dying, then there's probably not a good reason. And so something to that effect. And I really appreciated that she had really kind of found her breaking point with the Empire, but it wasn't one of those things where it, you know, a lot of people come over from the Empire and I feel like it's just so easy for them to fall into not being an Imperial. But I felt like Freed really does something smart here where it's very difficult for her to let go of what it means to be in the Imperial military, and what it means to be a soldier on that side and how they do things. I thought that that felt more realistic than sometimes the other side of what we see.
Yeah, and I thought that I really liked the revelation, I guess, that at the end, because the book opens with her explaining how she defected, but then near the end we see that that's not the truth, and that her breaking point wasn't all that noble. Like, she goes through and she carries out Operation Cinder, and it's afterwards that she is like, "What?" It's more of a "What have I done?" instead of like a "No, I can't do this, and I'm going to stand up for what's right." And her commanding officer just kind of lets her go. I really think that that's going to be cool to explore going forward. And I feel like maybe that secret's going to get out, because right now I think Karen is the only one that knows.
Mm-hmm.
To see if people do really still trust her. But I also liked, she was still like judgmental of Imperials that hadn't defected quite yet or quite as early as she had. And yeah, Quell is a really interesting character. And I like what you said about her having trouble letting go. She is reprimanded a couple times for thinking like an Imperial. And I loved the detail that the first time she gets into an X-Wing cockpit, she's like, what's this button for? Oh, they're shields, obviously, like, because our TIE fighters don't have them. But yeah, she's a very compelling character that, what you said is a good way to put it. She's very realistic.
Yeah, and I think the thing that really struck me about her as a character, like you said, is that throughout the whole book, we you know, Karen keeps saying to, you know, his droid, there's something she's not telling us. She's lying. And we find out that, yes, she has been lying. And I think that that's really interesting because, you know, she kind of has that moment that Anakin has in episode 3 where, you know, he chops off Mace Windu's hand and Mace Windu's gone and he just falls down. And he's like, what have I done? And that's basically her experience as well. But instead of turning, you know, back towards evil, she finds herself unable to do that. And I thought that that was really interesting because that's a whole conversation that we have throughout the entire book is about Operation Cinder and what's it for. And yeah. I found that really fascinating because we're tying into Battlefront, the game storyline there, or Battlefront 2, and bringing that to what the reality of that's like for the galaxy and everything. And the Imperials that follow that and the Imperials that don't and follow that. And I think, you know, when you put that together, the ones that go through with it, you know, those are the fanatics that are going to turn into the First Order. And that's what makes them more fanatical than even the Empire, you know, because we hear about in this book how the Empire, you know, it really hadn't made things better in the long run because people were just as corrupt as they were before. You know, the corruption had died down a little bit when the Empire first started, but then it picked back up because Imperials got in on the game with the corruption. And so the people that are willing to follow through with this order are the ones that are the most committed. They are the most crazy.
Well, I loved seeing things from Grandmother's point of view. The mm-hmm. the villain who kept like trying to talk to the Sentinel, the Emperor's droid, that would never turn back on and talk to her, but was still kind of moving around and doing stuff. And it's like, I know you're listening, and I'm trusting that everything is for a purpose. Like, she's carrying out everything she's told to do, but she has doubts, and she wants to know that it's worth something. And I was, A, surprised that she was killed in the first book. And that whole sequence with Nath was awesome. He sneaks aboard her Star Destroyer to do that. And B, I loved when the Sentinel like came up to her and I was like, oh, it's going to say something to her. And she's like, was it worth it? And he's like, nope, it doesn't say anything to her. It just turns his back on her. And it's like, it doesn't care about her. And the Emperor didn't either. I liked Grandmother a lot and how she was treated as kind of like Quell in a way that she had these doubts, but she was the version that kept on going.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that made it so fascinating is, you know, there's a quote in the book about how, you know, this isn't the first genocide that the Emperor has ordered. And, you know, there's a difference between, she's thinking, you know, like Alderaan or Lassan, and Operation Cinder is the difference between ruthlessness and cruelty. And, like, just how cruel this order is, because it is one to really separate the wheat from the chaff to see who is going to be willing to follow the Emperor even after death to the point of crazy, because there really isn't a point to this other than that is, and that's what will become again the First Order. And I think one of the things that this book does is that, you know, it's in that time period that everybody wanted. And it is helping kind of set up a lot of the things that we'll see then by the time we get to The Force Awakens and why things are the way they are. And I think, to me, you know, that's what made this book exciting, was actually seeing this time period. And this is exactly what I wanted, I think, from Aftermath, basically, but this is what's happening here. And I'm really excited that we're finally telling this story.
Yeah, I feel like Aftermath is going to wind up being kind of a broad strokes, like how we got to Operation Cinder and the Battle of Jakku and stuff. And I'm thinking that maybe Alphabet Squadron is going to get a little more granular into what happened. And I am a little bit wary that it'll just, the third book will end with the Battle of Jakku again, which I'm just like, we've seen it a lot at this point.
Why does everybody want to go back to Jakku?
Exactly. Like, I would be totally fine if they had their own mission off somewhere else. Maybe it was during the Battle of Jakku and it was also important and we got to see a new angle on what was going on at that point in time. But I'd be fine not seeing the Battle of Jakku for like a fifth time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you too. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, as we're kind of talking about this idea with Operation Cinder and everything, I think, you know, the thing that I felt like this book does very good is the tie-ins, you know, because I love the fact that he references his first Battlefront book with the Barma Battle Group and the fact that we're really diving into the reality of Battlefront 2's gameplay with Operation Cinder and the fallout there, the Imperial Remnant. And I just thought that was really interesting. But I also thought something that I wanted to ask you about in the idea of like kind of like tying this all together, because we're building that universe that's going to lead us to episode 7. And we have a character here who is very worried about the intelligence operations of the New Republic, and that it's not, he believes that it's not just brute force, basically, it's going to win them today. It's going to be being able to intelligently know where the best places to strike are. And of course, we've seen already that Mon Mothma is not all too keen about really continuing this war for much longer throughout other books. And the struggle that he's having here in the book of really having people see the legitimacy of intelligence. So I was wondering, as we kind of see Operation Cinder forming what will become, you know, the First Order, by who's going to follow that order, do you think that the lack of New Republic intelligence, or the lack of a really good New Republic intelligence agency, is what leads the First Order to be able to do what it does in the first place?
I hadn't made that connection. I think that's probably very smart. I really liked Cairn's obsession with intelligence, and I think he's right, because they make a big point about how the New Republic is not equipped to rule a galaxy yet. Like, they were not expecting to win at the Battle of Endor almost. And they said, like, we're not a faction that's used to winning wars. And now all of a sudden we have to control everything, and we're not set up to do that logistically. And they don't have the manpower to keep fighting effectively. So yeah, he's right that they need to strike intelligently and hit the Empire, or what's left of it, at the best spots. So yeah, I can totally see that maybe they for a while rely on intelligence for their fighting, and then once the war is over they just kind of abandon it because they want peacetime, and Mon Mothma was very into demilitarization. I also kind of get like a Littlefinger vibe from Game of Thrones. Yeah. About Cairn. Yes. Like, he seems very self-serving, so I'm wondering if maybe, like, yeah, he's right, but he'll do something that is going to negate everything that he's fighting for, and people will be like, maybe we shouldn't listen to that guy. And it's like, that, I don't know. That I think that's really smart, and there could be multiple ways to that end point of the New Republic just not having much intelligence at all, and Leia being the sole source of finding out what's going on with the First Order, and then the New Republic ignores it anyway.
Just as you were saying that, I was thinking that, you know, that's also kind of backed up by what we see in Resistance. You know, why else would you have to get somebody like Kaz to be a spy on a space station that you think is, you know, specifically a target for the First Order? I mean, like, if you already have an intelligence network, you're not sending somebody like Kaz to do this job, because
yeah.
Kaz is not the man for the job. It does feel like they are trying to find the stepping stones that help us get to that point to make this universe feel more filled out, so that we can actually understand the why of, like, the sequel trilogy finally, instead of just kind of feeling so rudderless in many ways. Like, we don't really understand the reality of how things are the way they are, so that it what we see in the films doesn't quite necessarily make as much sense. And so I like that we're kind of filling that in finally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely on board with, I wish there was a little bit more information on the New Republic, what was going on in The Force Awakens before it was just completely obliterated.
I mean, even in the movie would have been nice.
that's what I mean. That in the movie, we just get like nothing. And now I feel like they're going to start filling in those gaps, and we can see how things went from the way they are now in Alphabet Squadron. And over time, I guess, like, the next real point of reference is Bloodline, where everything is just so bipartisan and everyone's angry at each other and no one believes that the Empire could ever come back. And I think we'll see that slow degrade as we fill in those gaps, which I'm sure they will.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I appreciated, at least, you know, even though it doesn't make it better necessarily, but, you know, they mentioned, you know, Bob Iger has talked about the fact that, you know, they realized that they rushed some things with Star Wars. And I definitely think you can feel that all over the place in the sequel trilogy, you know, not as much in The Force Awakens, but it's when you get to The Last Jedi and it, you know, you, the timeline there has been very rushed, you know? And so you don't feel as cohesive as you would like it to be. But then too, I mean, you know, I think that was definitely my biggest issue with The Force Awakens in general, was that lack of information and that lack of understanding of what the galaxy is like. You know, whereas the other two series were very much so, it was easy to understand what was going on because it's so tied in with the world in which we have lived and our history of the world and our mythology and stuff. Whereas this trilogy is, you know, hasn't been, even though there are touchstones, that if they had really wanted to push them, they could have easily done so and made it a little bit more evident. So yeah, I'm just glad that some of those tie-ins were finally starting to get it. And I think us finally being in the post Endor era, like just right after that, I mean, mere weeks, months after Endor, it's just great to finally be in this position.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree about the sequel trilogy and the way that I think that The Force Awakens just had a lot of mandates where they were like, yeah. I think there was some pendulum swinging away from the prequel trilogy where they're like, no politics, let's get away from that. And we were like, we have all of the legacy actors and they're this age now, so we're going to make it this many years after Return of the Jedi. And they just had all of these like pre-made molds, I guess, that JJ then had to fit, and he had to make this movie that felt like Star Wars and introduced Star Wars to a new generation. And yeah, it you can kind of just feel that in the story. I think that that there were just all these prerequisites that were going into it, and now it's up to the books and the comics to kind of make it all make a little more sense. And I think that they're going to succeed, because what we've seen so far in the books and comics, I've been very pleased with. So
yeah, and it'll be JJ's job to this, try and put the bow on it now.
Yeah, so,
yeah. something that really I was thinking of. You know, we talked about tie-ins, and you know, the one of the coolest things when this book was being announced was the fact that it was going to involve Hera and that she was going to be a part of this story. And so I wanted to ask you, because she has, I would say, a muted role in the book. Was it enough for you? Did you want more? How did you feel like Freed handled her introduction into this series?
I could have stood to have a little more Hera, but I'm glad that I guess she wasn't overused. I guess there were just some things where she would start to talk about her past and what happened with Star Wars Rebels, and then they would kind of pull away from it. Like, no one was ever called by name. She didn't reminisce about Kanan. She didn't even talk about Jason. I was like, I want to know what's up with Jason Syndulla.
I mean, shouldn't her son be there? Because he's not that old at this point.
Right. Like, where is he? What daycare did she send him to?
New Republic daycare.
Yeah. It's just on a ship nearby that can, I guess, jump to light speed if danger arises. But yeah, I could have stood to use a little more, but she did have some really great scenes with Quell, and there was a good one with Nath. So it was a good balance, I think. I think maybe in Alphabet 2, Freed could lean a little more into Hera, bring her in a little bit more. But I guess it was a little cautious to just make sure that she didn't overshadow the new characters.
Yeah, I can definitely see that point. And I'm with you. I feel like I could have used a little bit more of her. And I think what he does with her is great. I will say this. If you're going to use Hera, I want her to be the only character that you could use in that position. Like, that there's a real sense that she belongs in the story, because Hera is the only one that should be in the story. Not just, oh, it's cool, we'll put Hera in there. And a part of me kind of feels like what she does in this story, any character could have done in the story. And that even the points,
I kind of see that.
Yeah.
Like, it very easily could have been swapped out with Lando or something like that. But there was this aspect of, I guess, Alphabet Squadron coming together as a family, and the crew of the Ghost was definitely a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think maybe that's what the inspiration for bringing Hera in was.
And I think you're right. And that's where I think you're right on target. Stay on target. Alphabet 2 will, have more of her, because this group has become more of a family, and she'll be part of that, because I felt like they kind of did use her to push them towards that. And I think this is where, you could go in many different directions with Karen and all that stuff. Like, maybe there's a internal battle between, following Karen and following Hera, because like you mentioned that Karen kind of has his own little desires, and maybe the group ends up, not wanting to be a part of what he's trying to build anymore. And so, I mean, there's lots of different ways that you could go where it really legitimizes us having Hera. I mean, I love Hera. She's one of my favorite Star Wars characters.
You're literally wearing a Hera shirt.
I am wearing a Hera shirt. and so I really appreciate the fact that she's here. And when we realized that she survived the end of the rebellion, she was at the Battle of Endor and all of those kind of things, I was ecstatic to have her here. I want to know where Jason is. Like, hashtag where's Jason? I would also, it seems strange to me that nobody in her crew is with her anymore. Like,
right. I feel like Zeb could be around.
Yeah.
Just name drop somebody and tell us where they are. That'd be cool.
This is kind of where I thought, I think Rex could still be there. That would have been really neat. So anyway, I mean, just all that to say, I guess I could never have enough Hera. So I would love to have more Hera in the story. I think that would be great. okay, so we should probably talk about some of these other characters. We talked about Erisa. Is that how you say your name? Is it?
I've been calling her Erica, basically. I just figured Erica. It was the Star Wars version of Erica.
I like that. Okay. Yeah, we'll go with Erica.
My wife says that they say it Erica in the audio.
Okay, there you go. We'll go with that. Chas was really a funny character, a really interesting character, and she flies a B-Wing, which made me a fan already because I love B-Wings, and they don't get enough love in the Star Wars universe. But what I loved about her character, too, is that, and Freed loves to use Rogue One stuff, which I love him for. The fact that she is a fan and idolizes Jyn and actually had met her because Jyn saved her life once was just, I mean, I know it's small universe, but I honestly didn't care. I really liked that Rogue One is a part of Star Wars now, and we're getting people that remember Jyn and that group sacrifice as much as they remember, you know, Skywalker and Solo.
I really liked that, yeah, Chas idolizes Jyn, but specifically, like, the fact that she gave her life for a cause. And so Chas, throughout the story, almost has, like, this, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say death wish, but, like, she wants to die in the glory of battle for some big cause. And, like, Will keeps stopping her, basically. Although, like, I don't think that if she were to die at either of those two points in the book, it wouldn't have been something along the lines of Jyn. So, like, I think she's a little misguided, but yeah, I like that inspiration for her. I love that she listens to music while she flies. I thought that was an awesome detail. And I love seeing people put Chas playlists up on Twitter.
Yeah, that's so funny because just last week on Aggressive Negotiations, we were talking about in-universe pop music, and then we kind of, like, transitioned to talking about what characters would listen to, you know, from our universe. And it was kind of interesting to get a character that has that, you know, like, that likes music, and that, just like us, you know, has, you know, lots of people exercise to music, or, you know, ride their bike to music, or, you know, most of us drive to music a lot of times, you know, so, like, that just fact that she flies to music is fantastic. You know, I just want to, if it ever happens to her, she randomly has, you know, the sappy love song come on her playlist and, like, no, not that song. Like,
yeah, not now.
Not now. But no, yeah, I agree with you. Like, I thought it was interesting that she is a Thielen with a cause, like, or she wants to be. She wants to be somebody who is maybe too willing to give their life for a cause. And that part of that is, again, we get down to the psychology of these characters, and part of that is the psychological trauma that she's been through, and she's lost so many people, and part of her pushing so hard is that maybe she is a kind of feeling like she might be better off dead, but she wants to go out giving her life for a cause too, but there's so much pain there that that's the only way she can. She's not going to commit suicide, but she's willing to die at the drop of a hat, basically, in battle. And yeah, that's a very dangerous place to be. So I'm interested to see how they continue that, and if it's something that will change then in Alphabet 2 and 3 as she gets closer to this group.
Yeah.
So Karos is the strangest character I've ever encountered in a Star Wars novel, I think. She's the U-Wing pilot, which is awesome because I love U-Wings, but we know so little about her, mainly because she is covered from head to toe. She has a mask on her face, and the only thing we really got from her backstory is that Darth Vader had come to her planet. That's what we get the feeling like Darth Vader had been involved with something on her planet. And that's about it.
That's, yeah, I remember in the first third of the book reading about Kairos, and I was like, is this Hera? I was wondering if she was going to, like, pop the mask off and be like, oh my gosh, it's Hera. But nope. We have no idea what's going on with her. And see, I'm interested to hear where you got the Darth Vader part, because I mean, I read that little her origin story, and I couldn't pull much out of it. But if you caught something cool, then I want to know.
I think it's when she's telling her story, and she mentions in the story she's telling, she says somebody in with a mask. I think it was, and I kind of got the feeling like the way that she was telling the story, because they were, I think, trying to shoot that character, and it felt like something where blaster bolts are flying around, so you got almost this feeling of lightsaber. Mm. So again, I could be totally off, because this is very esoteric storytelling that she's doing, because she's literally doing hand motions and stuff while telling the story.
Yeah, like drawing in the sand.
Yeah.
And like everything but talking.
Yes. Which she can talk, because we actually hear her talk a couple of times. Well, you know, we read her talk a couple of times. And so it was just really fascinating. That, and we also get this feeling like she has some sort of debt to Karen. Mm. And that was really interesting as well, because again, I love your pull that he kind of feels like Littlefinger, where he's collecting all of these people that owe him a debt. And then, you know, he kind of feels like the Godfather, you know, one day I'll ask you to do this favor for me, you know, like, and you will do it. So yeah, she is a mystery. Now, I had a wild theory. Just want to run it by you. I kind of thought maybe with the disguise that she has and the mask, possibly that she is a Jedi who is been in hiding. It's just a question.
I have no way to say no, as we know so little. Like my first gut reaction is like, okay, we see a character in a mask. Why don't we see their face? Right. That's a little different in a book. But like in the upcoming Fallen Order game, the second sister Inquisitor, everyone, including myself, was like, oh, maybe it's Barriss Offee. And then the developer's like, it's not. But just if they're hiding the face, I'm like,
yeah,
why are they hiding their face? I assume that it's someone we know under there. But I don't know, when it's in a book, I'm like, maybe not.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, you know, because they've put the artwork out of what these characters look like.
Right.
And her mask is very unique looking. And it kind of, I don't know, it has this Kylo Ren-ish feel to it in some ways. It also has some weird bounty hunter looks to it, you know, like,
yeah. It's
kind of a conglomeration of a lot of things we've seen. I think she's the character I'm actually most intrigued by in the book, just because she is such a mystery. And the very little bit that we get about her just makes me wonder a lot. So I think she's the one I'm most excited to kind of follow throughout the rest of these two books, where we can finally get, hopefully, some reveals about. Hopefully she doesn't turn into the Snoke of this series, where we just don't know anything about.
She is Snoke. I think you just figured it out.
That's the theory. She's Snoke. Okay, I like it.
Snoke's sister, maybe.
Snoke's sister. I love it. So Will is, I think, like our everyday character. Like, he's our everyman. And I thought he was just a really interesting character because, you know, he comes from kind of a backwater planet. He kind of, in that way, feels a little Luke Skywalker-ish, you know. But he's not necessarily somebody who really ever really wanted to leave home. So we have the opposite of that. And I thought that was really interesting to get somebody whose only goal here is really just to go home. And I kind of enjoyed that, because we don't see that a lot in Star Wars, where the character's like, you know what, I've just kind of had enough of all this. I'd just like to go home. And I found him, you know, he, as all the characters do on the team, he's just so likable.
Yeah. Will was my favorite of the group. I totally agree with you that it's like the opposite of the call to action, almost, where Luke has that moment where he's standing out looking at the sunset. Like, Will never had that moment. He was like, I never wanted to leave, but he was the best pilot in his village, so he had to. And he was like, okay, I'll do my duty. And then he's like, his first chapter, he is going home the next day. And then he gets swept up into all this stuff. He was one day from retirement. And then he gets stuck into this fight with Chas at first. But just watching him during that first third of the book, while Shadow Wing is chasing them through hyperspace over and over, which that was a cool little mystery, because when they first reveal, like, we're being chased through hyperspace, I was like, but hyperspace tracking hasn't been developed yet. How are they doing this? And then you slowly get to piece it together. But that part where there's almost a no man's land, like, both capital ships are not destroyed. What am I thinking of? They're deactivated. And so the rebel pilots are protecting theirs, and the TIE fighters are protecting theirs, and no one's really fighting. And Will, like, tries to radio the TIE pilots and just start talking to them. I thought that was, I wrote it on the page of the book that, like, this is the moment I fell in love, where the story just kicked off for me. And from that point on, I was hooked.
You brought that up. And so as I was doing a reread of the book, I was thinking, and what came to mind in that scene was that that famous armistice during World War I, where both sides came together on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like Will is kind of trying to have that moment. You know, he's like, we got nothing else to do. And basically, it's so interesting because he's respecting the TIE pilots as actual people, you know, and the TIE pilot doesn't do the same in return. You know, we see the difference of basically, and it really brings home that the Imperial, the thought process of everybody who's not an Imperial, which is basically you're less than us, and we don't see you as a full being, basically. You're not worthy of our respect whatsoever. And that really brought that moment home, and I thought that was a really cool way to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was fully like, oh, cool, he's going to have this conversation with the TIE fighter pilot. And, like, at first it kind of starts out where he's, like, figuring out which specific TIE fighter this guy he's talking to flies. Blink, I think, because he had one missing blaster cannon. But then, yeah, pretty quickly, Blink just does not reciprocate any friendship and is just like, we're going to kill you and blah, blah, blah. And that, I was like, oh my gosh, this did not go the way I was expecting. But I love that scene.
Yeah, it is a good scene. And I think, like you said too, it is a moment that helps us kind of see the goodness of the character of Will, which is nice. Because he is kind of that character that everybody on the team relates to, and even Chas, who is angry with him, can't actually hate him because of the character that he has. And I thought that was really cool, because by the end of the book, everybody on the team really is much closer. And that was, he is definitely a part, I think, of bringing them together, because he's also the one who helps kind of force the conversations while they're camping and really make that a thing where people start telling their stories. And I thought that was really, again, he becomes the glue of the group, which is, you know, that's you need that character. So, and you just need that person in reality too. Like anybody who has a group of friends knows they have that one person in the group who's just kind of the one that keeps everybody truly together. So, Nath was really, what I loved about him is that he's the character that does definitely seem to have his own agenda. And I'm not quite sure I know what his own agenda is. I mean, I know he wanted to kill Shadow Squadron, but it seems like he's just got something else going on too, and I'm really fascinated to see where else we go with this character.
Yeah, like, he partly seems like he's out for money, partly seemed like he wanted to go get revenge on grandmother. I also like that he was an early defector from the Empire, but not, again, for noble reasons. It was because he was corrupt and the Empire found out and they were going to kill him. And he's like, yes, I'm a rebel now. So he's got like he's the scoundrel of the crew, I guess, where you're like, I'm not sure where this guy is, where he lies, and if we can completely trust him, which is he's another one that's like he's likable, frustratingly likable, and everyone seems to get along with him, but you don't know if you can trust him yet.
That's the thing that I really liked him. There's that moment where Yurika has painted the Alphabet Squadron logo on all of their ships. And he's like, don't ever touch my ship again. But then he can't keep from smirking at the same time, like that he's not really mad that this happened.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's just this kind of thing, like you said, he is very much that lovable scoundrel. Like you can't really dislike him. And I find that interesting because, you know, obviously Star Wars does that a lot. So what it makes me wonder is if we'll follow kind of, you know, the Star Wars trope for the scoundrel with him, or if there will be something more to it. And I think that's an interesting story to follow.
Yeah. I mean, will he go the way of Han Solo or DJ? Like, which kind of, is he completely out for himself, or does he believe in anything else? And at this point, it's a coin toss.
So it's called Alphabet Squadron. Which ship would you want to fly?
It's always been a tough choice between X and A-Wing for me. I really like the A-Wing for speed, but X-Wing is, I always wind up choosing that, I would say, if I'm going into play Battlefront or something. It's probably my favorite starfighter design, period. So I guess I'll go X-Wing. It's good all around.
Yeah, that's very true. I think I'd go B-Wing. I just love that ship. It's really cool. And again, I'm just glad that they're playing around with all of these different ships that, you know, as much as I love the X-Wing squadron, right, it is kind of fun to have a squadron that's made up of just a completely ragtag group, which is great.
I loved, yeah, that Freed points out, one of my friends, another YouTuber named Space Doc, when this book was announced, he made a very tongue-in-cheek video about why mixed starfighter squadrons are a terrible idea, because it's like, okay, you have an A-Wing and a Y-Wing, and the Y-Wing can't go nearly as fast as the A-Wing, so the speed of the A-Wing is negated, and he like went into all these nitpicky things, and he was like, I know I'm being nitpicky, and this is mostly just for fun, but then Alexander Freed addresses all of that in the book, where it's like, this makes no sense, but it's what we have, and like the A-Wing, but there are times where Will is like flying circles around them, just trying to stay near his group. And I was very impressed with how technical the starfighter writing was. It matched what the X-Wing books used to be. So I was very impressed by that.
Yeah, I would say, I think Alexander Freed's books in general, just talking about, you know, the idea of ships and starfighters and stuff, like, I feel like his books are the most Star Wars wars books out there. Like, it truly feels like you're reading a book about the military. I mean, if you read Battlefront, yeah, it's a military book before even almost it's a Star Wars book. And I think in a lot of ways, this book is very much about, this is like, you know, Star Wars Top Gun kind of thing, except there's nothing Top Gun about these these pilots and their ships. You know, this is like your crap squadron. Like, you know, like you said, this doesn't even make any sense to put all together. But what I love about it is, again, it feels very military based. And I think there's room for that. You know, like you mentioned, the fact that the old X-Wing books used to be very much like that, and people loved them. I think part of the reason they loved them is because of that. You know, it's the reason why you go to so many cons and there are the military of Star Wars panels. You know, people love the military aspect of Star Wars, And these books like this really put that front and center. And that's great that they're doing that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So there is a whole other side to this book, and it is a very small story. But it turns out that the whole other character that we're following, Devin, is actually Major Soren. And I wanted to ask you, how did that work for you in the storyline?
I think by his final part, I had caught on that, especially because his last chapter was after Erica told Karen the real story about her defection and how Soren let her go. And knowing that he was alive, I was like, oh, that's Devin. Okay. I kind of get the feeling, or I wonder if they decided to make this book a trilogy, like in the middle of writing it. And he was like, oh, I need to like do an MCU tease for the future. So like he added in the Devin chapters. I don't know if that's true or not. I could just, they came out of nowhere. They were like at the end of every part of the story. So I was just like, I could see that happening, or maybe they meant it to be a trilogy the whole time. I don't know. But yeah, it did excite me at the end, knowing that he's, I guess, still out there. And he like tried to separate himself from the fight, but it didn't work. And so I guess now he's going to go back to the Empire, because it's all he knows. So I'm interested to see that conflict, especially if, I mean, he has to run into Quell at some point, and oh, yeah. She has this history with him, and it's not an unfriendly history. So yeah. That'll be an interesting meeting.
I agree in that aspect, that part, that the setup there for the fact that they will meet sometime is that's what I'm looking forward to. I definitely think that the editing for this story with him, I honestly think that you could have cut out all of those other parts with him and just had the end basically stinger, like an MCU, like just do that, and it would have been much more effective. Have her tell her story, and then the stinger at the end of the book is, you know, him coming, you know, being like, I'm going back, you know?
Yeah.
And I think because otherwise I didn't see enough validity to spend that much time with him, you know, throughout, because it wasn't super interesting really. And I don't know. I just felt like the editing on that part, they should have found a better way to introduce him than, you know, just kind of these random chapters that really don't have an impact on the rest of the story until that last reveal. And even with the last reveal, it doesn't feel like you earned spending that much time, just me personally.
I think that you're probably right, that it could have just been boiled down to one little chapter where, I mean, I kind of enjoyed the little story of him going to this village and then teaching the villagers how to stand up for themselves. Like maybe that could have been the last chapter, but then at the end of that, the New Republic comes and tries to assassinate him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, because then you'd be like, yeah, I'm on this guy's side. Oh, the New Republic's trying to kill him. Oh, they just drove him back to the Empire. Oh, no.
Yeah, no, I think that's that. Yeah, I think we just fixed the problem. So why aren't we editors? We should just be editors, Alex. So I do have, like, before we wrap up and kind of rate the book, I do have one question, because obviously this is going to get compared to the X-Wing series. And how did this compare for you? And did this kind of scratch that itch that I know as fans, so many of us have been kind of wanting a series like that. Did this do it for you? And do you feel like it kind of lived up to the legacy of... of the X-Wing series?
I think so. It definitely scratched my itch for some pilot stories. Like, I would consider this probably tied with my two other favorite Star Wars canon novels right now, Lost Stars and Thrawn. Like, these are now my three number ones. I don't know if I could separate out which one I like the most. The X-Wing books, especially Rogue Squadron, that was like one of the first Star Wars books I ever read. So it's, I don't know if anything's ever going to like top that for me just because nostalgia. And like I've reread it recently just to make sure it held up, and it does. So I think it was a very worthy successor. Part of me is a little like bummed knowing that it's just a trilogy, because I really miss having these series of books like Legends used to have. I mean, there's 11 X-Wing books, and there's the New Jedi Order, and I know people aren't crazy about it, but I like that the books had like these ongoing stories that took a long, long time to tell that you could get invested in. So I'm glad that we're going to get a taste of that with Alphabet Squadron. I kind of hope they leave it open to tell more starfighter stories. Like, I guess maybe I wish it were called, that wouldn't make any sense. I couldn't call it X-Wing Alphabet Squadron, but I wish that I could know that we were going to continue these starfighter type stories.
No, I think you have a really valid point. You know, I remember, and it's been not too long ago, probably within the last 5 years, I think, that I read the Rogue Squadron series. And I thought the Rogue Squadron series was excellent. And specifically for the way in which, because the Thrawn series had jumped ahead 5 years, that X-Wing series, the beginning of it, really filled in, you know, them liberating like Coruscant, and you built all the way up to that. You know, you and like you said, you really were, you had something to look forward to, and this was a long running series. And you know, I'm wondering if after the Rise of Skywalker they will be able to do that, because they have this 30 year gap that they've got stuff to fill in, and God knows they need to do that. As we were kind of mentioning, that we would love to have more of this connective fiber to, you know, that trilogy. And so this is definitely, I think, a good way that you could do that. Is this is a series that, yes, you could tell this trilogy here, but you could easily do another trilogy after this.
Yeah, I think that they probably will, after the Rise of Skywalker, kind of open the floodgates on the time period between Jedi and Awakens, because like they're doing so much now where I think they're gonna tell, like, they could take something like X-Wing and make it a Disney Plus series now, where some of those smaller stories that used to, they would have been books back in Legends, but now they could be TV series. And so, but there are things like whatever happened to Luke during that time period, you can't make that a series. I mean, I guess I would prefer it not be a series. People say Sebastian Stan could play Luke Skywalker, and I'm like, yeah, he looks like him, but I'd rather just read a book. I'd rather read a lot of books about Luke than see someone else play Luke, I guess. But it worked for Alden, so what do I know?
You know, I mean, yeah, they could totally do that. You know, I honestly thought that the Luke series would have been a good animated series.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that this sets up, in many ways, what the Rogue Squadron books did for the X-Wing series, and it is something that I feel like I want to follow. And so you mentioned that this is in your top three, which is big time for the new canon. That's amazing. If you were going to rate it, say, out of five, what would you give it, do you think?
I'd probably give it a five. For me,
oh, that's great.
It hit everything I wanted it to. It actually did more than I was expecting. It exceeded my expectations, so I'd give it a five.
That's great, man. You know, it's interesting because I rated this, I think when I wrote the review, 3.75 out of five. But I do think that I would go ahead and bump it up to 4 out of 5 in the reread. Like, I really enjoyed the book a little bit more on the reread. And I think part of that was that I felt a little bit more connected to the characters than I did in the first go round. And that was the only drawback I had kind of at the beginning. Like, I felt like one of the things I love that Freed is doing in this book is he's really playing with a lot of themes. of war and the cost in surviving war and what it means to survive, and what it means, you know, what does it mean to go from being a rebellion to a governing body, you know, and all of these kind of things, all those exciting things. And I wasn't quite as connected with the characters, but I felt like this read, I was able to get a better hook with the characters. I really do like this book. I think the most exciting part is, for me, is that we're finally in the time period and kind of telling the stories that, I mean, we're not playing with the big three here, but we are telling stories that really are laying that foundation for what the sequel trilogy universe is. Yeah. Which, to me, that's super exciting, and I really can't wait to read more, because Fried has done a great job of setting up a lot of great mysteries now surrounding all these characters, and I want to see how they play out. So I'm excited to get more of this series, and I'm glad I got a chance to talk about it. I'm so glad you wanted to come on and talk about it, because a lot of fun. I really want to say thank you to our associate producers through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Wyan Millett, and Daniel Noah, for supporting the network each and every week through Patreon. Every month, they support this network to make sure all of the shows keep coming to you, especially the 602 Club. And we need your help, just like they have given us their help. And so go over to patreon.com/trekfm. You can see how you can become part of our team. Make sure all of the podcasts we do keep coming to you each and every week. You can give at certain contribution levels we have, but honestly, every little bit helps. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Alex, so much fun to have you on the show here. Obviously, welcome back anytime you want to talk some Star Wars or heck, anything else that we're covering. But let everybody know where they can find you online and about Star Wars Explained.
Yeah, our YouTube channel is called Star Wars Explained. I run it with my wife, Molly, and we keep up with all of the books and the comics and the TV shows when they're on, and the future Disney Plus series, and anything that comes out, I take it in and we review it. We talk about the big points and just try to help simplify the galaxy far, far away, since it's so massive and there's so much to keep up with. And I try to make sure people who are just interested in like the movies can make sure they know everything that happened in the books that might be relevant and stuff like that. Our YouTube channel is Star Wars Explained. We're also on Twitter at Star Wars Explain, and we're on Instagram and Facebook. We're everywhere. So, yeah, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely, man. And definitely check it out. One of the things I love that you do is, you know, how you'll kind of give all the bullet points for the comics and stuff if you're having trouble keeping up with all the stuff that's coming out. So it's an excellent resource for anybody that's at any level of fandom, honestly. So man, thanks for being on. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd under the name MattRushing02. I'm here on the network also doing a show called The Orb with Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network doing two shows. One's called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman, and that's where we talk about the Harry Potter series one chapter at a time. And we are actually in The Order of the Phoenix right now. We're almost done with that book, actually. We only have about 9 chapters left, so it's very cool. Check that out. I'm also doing Aggressive Negotiations there on the Nerd Party, talking Star Wars with John Mills each and every week. So I hope that you will check that out. And then last but not least, I'm doing a show called Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney, and that's where we talk about films, but through the lens of faith. And we want to say thank you so much for joining us, and may the Force be with you. ¶¶